If you've been told to pull up your socks, then make sure it's a pair of TNT socks. The TNT shop is now open at tntradio.live. Pella Nuroth-Taylor, live from Sweden, on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to the Pella Nuroth-Taylor Show on this Thursday afternoon. If you're wondering why I'm in a different place, it's because I'm in Malmö at the moment, where the Eurovision Song Contest is taking place. If you say the word Swedish music, I guess 90% of people will tell you ABBA. ABBA is one of the great bands in history, I think. They were very unfashionable in the beginning, but they think their melodic tunes, which are deeply ensconced in the Swedish melodious tradition, are a winner with most people. I think they're probably one of the best-selling bands in history. And interestingly, the head of the studio in Brisbane at TNT was actually in Australia as a young reporter covering the ABBA tour that famously became a film, ABBA the Movie, in 1977. And he knew a lot of people who were in that film. He's a cub reporter then. So he'll be watching this with bated breath. And of course, ABBA and Australia have a very special relationship somehow. I think they had more hits there than anywhere else. Anyway, apart from ABBA, Sweden is probably more famous in some circles, at least for younger circles, perhaps for winning a lot of Eurovision Song Contests, I think more than anyone else apart from the Irish. And as a result of winning last year's contest in Liverpool, they are now hosting this year's show in Sweden's third largest city. Malmö, which has a population of 350,000. I grew up some years here. Most of my time was spent growing up in London, but my mother's from this town and some here now. And a lot of tension has been expected because it's a heavily Muslim city and there's an Israeli contestant. I think she's singing tonight originally a song that was actually about the October 7th attacks. But then Eurovision put its foot down and said, no, that's too political. So they've got a more calmer title. Apparently, everything's calm. There are snipers on the roofs here in the arena and police on motorbikes everywhere. Very unusual to have that kind of safety. But of course, the Swedes know that the chance of a bust up are great. But so far, nothing's happened. And rather, all around town, there's sort of folk festivities, you know, global restaurant streets, that sort of thing. And I'll go out and check it out later. I just want to introduce our four guests. By the way, I mean, I'm not a fan of Eurovision at all. The question is, though, whether, and it's a sad, I'm going to talk about it in the next hour, it's the only thing that Europeans really have in common. And whereas it used to be characterized by young, svelte, French-speaking women who sang about peace in their own language, it's now dominated by showstoppers called Bambi Thug and Baby Lasagna. Baby Lasagna is probably a favorite. And people getting out of eggs on stage in their very revealing underpants, males with 120 kilos, not young, svelte women sort of thing. So anyway, we'll talk more about Eurovision and its and Europe in general, where we're going as Europeans, surrounded by superpowers and wars on our doorstep. But we've got four guests, three of whom are Swedish and who I'm interviewed in my past documentaries. They're from around this area. In one case, is a professor at Lund University, which is Sweden's top university. He's going to talk to us about feminism and how it's gone too far and censoring free thinking at universities. We've talked about that before, but it'll give us a specifically Swedish angle. That's Erik Olsson. We've got Ingrid Karlqvist, a returning guest, and she's going to talk about, well, where the fate of the Jewish people in Malmö. There were quite a lot here once, but Muslim-Jewish tensions led to the exodus of them. But she'll talk about other things. Because she was once the local news editor of one of Sweden's largest papers, but based here in Malmö. And she'll tell us a little bit about the history of the city that's changed so much. We've got Johan Adamsson, who is also a professor locally and who's in one of my documentaries. His controversial support of free speech has led to his ousting from the Malmö University, which is not nearly as good as Lund University, very politically correct. And simply for lecturing on John Stuart Mill. And quoting John Stuart Mill's words. And John Stuart Mill, of course, is the champion philosopher of free speech, and that was not acceptable, apparently. But I think that although Sweden was very bad at free speech when I first arrived, I do think that the Anglo countries really have caught up and probably got worse than Sweden now, with what's going on in Canada and Scotland, for instance. And But our first guest is Matt Campbell, whose brother died at 9/11. He's pursued the topic of what really happened in 9/11 ever since. That's 22 years ago. And he was working, the brother was working at the Risk Waters Analysis Group, which I think was above the impact position in one of the towers. I can't remember which. But there's a little personal angle I thought I'd reveal there too, because I had a friend at a school at Westminster, Ollie Bennett, who was actually also died in that, worked for that company and died then. And I sometimes think about him because he used to be my fag at school. That's the British public school speak for the young boy who comes and wakes you up in the morning and makes toast or whatever. Anyway, so I'm looking forward to that, Matt Campbell, at 20 past. But we're going to talk to Basil Valentine, our political editor, perhaps about the latest war of words, so far only war of words between the British and the Russians, and maybe other things, of course, Israel and the Middle East. We'll be back after a very quick break with Basil Valentine, our political editor. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk on this Friday afternoon.
Getting straight to the facts.
Enough with the lies. We need facts.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good afternoon, Basil. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. Probably the hottest day of the year so far here in England. Proper okay. Early summer weather for a change.
Right.
Yes. Makes okay. A change. We're going to go all the way to North Macedonia around first story, Pelle, where the opposition nationalists have swept to power this week, putting them on a collision course with European Union neighbours Greece and Bulgaria. The right-wing VMRO-DPMNE party earned an easy victory, with the ruling Social Democrats conceding defeat before any results had even been announced, prompting fireworks throughout the capital Skopje as the landslide victory was announced. The new incoming prime minister has refused to acknowledge the country's new name and the historic agreement with Greece in 2018, which added North to its title to settle a long-running dispute in allowing the country to join NATO. The opposition leader has also vowed to stand firm in a tussle with Bulgaria over linguistic and historical issues that have been Sofia block on North Macedonia's EU accession for the last 2 years. Bulgaria is demanding Skopje change its constitution to acknowledge the Bulgarian minority. The fallout from the disintegration of Yugoslavia continues apace, Pelle. Who knew?
Mm. Well, so the nationalists won. Is that what's their stance on Russia versus NATO? Since everybody falls into these two camps in Eastern Europe these days, or at least in our ignorant Western framing, I guess.
Well, that's a good question. I think this lot want to join NATO. That's one of their main planks, I believe. But they're really concerned with, immediately
minorities.
Local. Go on.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was just going through the manuscript of my First World War book, and I found there's a lot of talk there about, the Balkan Wars. There was a tinderbox. I don't think it'll be a tinderbox for a future conflict now. It's not interesting, and the Russian borders have receded, as it were, but Russian zone of influence. But the Macedonians are, the Serbs describe them as Serbs, and the Bulgarians describe them as Bulgarian. And there's a kind of linguistic continuum between Serbian and Bulgarian, I mean, Macedonian in the middle, and then Bulgarian. And you could make claims that it's either language, really. Like I said, maybe it's a bit like Ukrainian or Russian. I don't know. This is a thing that gets hate mail whenever it's written about, because people have very, very, very strong opinions about this, and dispute it ad nauseam. So it's a very live issue. And of course, Bulgaria and Serbia fought a war over this back in 1912. And history matters for a lot of countries. They stick to these dates. It's only in our globalized West. Go to Iran, they'll talk about events that happened in the 600s. Go to the Middle East, Israel, they talk about things that happened 3,000 years ago. So talking about something that merely happened 100 years ago, the Balkan Wars of 1912, is no time at all.
It's extraordinary. It is still very, tribal, dare I say, religio-ethnic. Is that a term, Pelle? in terms of the way people vote. You know, for example, there's an Albanian party, the DUI, with Albanians making up more than a quarter of the country's population of 1.8 million. And this incoming Prime Minister Mikoski was using particularly aggressive language towards the Albanian party. Its leader led a brief armed revolt for greater rights for Albanians in 2001. Of course, this whole North Macedonia business, this is particularly peculiar, really, because there's also a region of northern Greece called Macedonia. And North Macedonia, which would like to call itself Macedonia and drop the North, considers itself to be the real Macedonia. And the Macedonia in Greece isn't really Macedonia at all. Of course, the Greeks say the opposite, that the region in the north of Greece is the real Macedonia. And North Macedonia is simply that, and they're lucky to call themselves that. A really peculiar situation. It's as if they were...
Well, for a long time, they called themselves Phyron, former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. So everybody went around talking about this country, Phyron, and now, I guess, North Macedonia is a kind of compromise. And then there's that Albanian conflict. You're a French expert, as you assure us. Macedoine means a salad with many vegetables. And I guess that comes from the old Macedonia being a mixed up place.
That's quite possibly chopped up in a rich mayonnaise, if you will. Let's hope they don't resort to arms again, but it's constantly bubbling under down there with these different religious and ethnic groups. You know, this represents a big shift to the right. To, you know, this chap has obviously appealed to Macedonian culture and heritage. And I'm not inherently opposed to nationalism, but in some parts of the world, it's particularly dangerous. When you think about it, it's absolutely extraordinary that Tito managed to hold together that whole Yugoslavia for as long as he did. You know, I mean,
there's a lot of nostalgia for Yugoslavia. I was quite fond of Yugoslavia.
Yeah, I can understand that.
And in fact, anyway,
go on.
No, I'm quite. I made a case for the Habsburg Empire, which included Austria, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia, and that was quite. But again, a lot of people say, well, that's like the European Union, and a lot of it broke up. It was a proto-European Union, and the reason why the Czechs and so on, the Poles, are so skilled at bureaucratic infighting in Brussels is because it's in their blood. They did it in the Habsburg Empire. And in the end, that very rather benign place was, they didn't ever talk about anything than national rights, you know, and had to close down the parliament and rule by decree. But it was quite a benign construction, I think, much better than the nation states that followed after, you know, Poland, and who were sort of fascist, you know.
Yes, I don't like the idea of Ursula von der Leyen as the Holy Roman Empress, Pelle.
No. Well, she's unpopular, apparently. Macron wants to get rid of her, that horrible woman.
Well, that's the best news I've heard all week. But, as is always the case, who on earth is going to replace them? Just to bring us up to date with the tinderbox situation in the Middle East, the strikes on Rafah continue. More than 100,000 people have fled. Not that there's anywhere to go. Disgracefully, David Cameron has said that the UK will not be following the United States in withholding arms sales to Israel should the ground incursion of Rafah escalate. Notably, of course, Joe Biden said last night that United States will not be supplying the munitions to Israel if it goes ahead with its full-scale invasion of Rafah. We're currently teetering on the brink. Biden, of course, has managed to alienate both his base in terms of progressive Democrats represented by the students and the student protests, which incidentally are now all over the world. And I heard earlier from Trinity College Dublin today, they have acceded to the students' demands and are divesting completely from all companies to do with Israel, etc. So a very different response from University College Dublin there than from universities in the United States who've gone in with riot police. Cameron says he's not going to follow the US, saying the positions are not comparable since the UK is not a large state-to-state arms supplier to Israel. So Biden has managed to lose his base, who will never forgive him for facilitating the genocide. And now by refusing to sanction the last stage of the horror. He's losing support amongst all his Zionist donors, of course. So no wins.
Well, just that Cameron statement, did he make it during the his speech? He made some foreign policy speech. It's his first big foreign policy speech after jetting around the world for 6 months.
Yes, that's right.
And that was, I was going to try and avoid talking about Ukraine for at least one day, but it presses upon me this. There's a very, he talked about standing firm against the Russians, and you know, we were all waiting. There's radio silence from the Brits after Russia made its threat to attack British assets, after allegedly Cameron saying last week we're going to send our missiles into Russia, and there's a quite, he said we're standing, it's all a bit boilerplate, but you don't know what's really going on there. There's a very aggressive article in the Telegraph this morning, which is very close links to the military, talking about, well, basically, I'll sum it up. The Americans don't like us, but they're cowards and we don't care. The Russians don't like us, but they're weak as well. Their economy is, but we have the best special forces in the world and they're very close to the front line, and we can't let Putin nuclear blackmail us. And that's how, to me, that's the voice of the SAS and the special forces and MI6, who are kind of really fervently fighting this war against Russia. And I just want to know if anyone's got control over them. I mean, if you it's like a delinquent teenage child. I don't care about my parents. I don't care about anyone. I'll just go do my thing. And openly admitting that the relationship with the United States is terrible among these people. The lines have probably been going hot from the Americans saying, de-escalate, de-escalate. But, you know, whether it's just words of frustration from the British or words of defiance, I don't know.
A good question. I mean, we've been amongst the hawkish, haven't we, since the beginning. One bright spark, the Slovakian foreign minister said he thought it was time for talks. So I think in Central Europe, they're starting to have had enough of it. But us on this island in the northwest of Europe, we're that bit further away. Cameron explicitly linked foreign policy with immigration and economic policy in his speech this morning, saying the whole country needs to share in the benefits of globalization and that foreign policy is about prosperity too. Well,
that's good to hear. Well, it comes from
peace, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, he does. You have to pick out the relevant bits with the speeches. You know, some of it's persiflage and some of it's kind of serious and aimed at certain audiences. Anyway, Basil, we'll talk more in the next hour. We'll have your Eurovision tip, no doubt. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We're off to our first guest of the afternoon, Matt Campbell, after a very quick break. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
TNT's Jason Burmes.
What is hate speech? Let me give you a good idea what hate speech is. It's a great excuse to create laws to make it illegal for people to think and say things. And this is a very, very dangerous avenue that we've been going down for some time. But now, with the passing of this anti-Semitism bill by Congress, it has become more real and frightening than ever.
Jason Burmes on today's News Talk, TNT.
Whatever happened to good? It's a word that gets thrown around a lot, and it's become our automatic answer to so much.
Hey, how's things?
Good.
Your mum, your weekend?
Good, good. Is good even that good anymore? At the Selbos, we believe good deserves better. Let's reclaim its true meaning. To us, good has always been about making a difference, and good never picks or chooses who it helps. Isn't it time we all remember what good really means?
Am I on the air?
You're on the air.
On the air 24/7. Your news talk giant, TNT.
Welcome to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Thursday afternoon. We've got Matt Campbell with us, who's the brother of Jeff Campbell, a British citizen who was killed on the 11th of September 2001 while attending a Risk Waters conference on the 106th floor of the North Tower. Since November 2001, he's been actively researching 9/11 after campaigning for justice for his brother. He's contributed to a number of 9/11 documentaries, including Incontrovertible, The Last Secrets of 9/11, Surviving 9/11, and The Unspeakable. He's here to discuss, well, his arc of discovery, and maybe a little bit, talk a little bit about his brother, and discuss the latest court filing in his fight for 9/11 justice. Welcome to the show, Matt. I'll just say one thing quickly. I had a friend, Ollie Bennett. I don't know if you've heard the name, because his parents founded the Ollie Bennett Trust. He was a journalist with Risk Waters, and he died on that floor as well. So, yeah, just a short thing. But anyway, carry on. What you tell us a little bit about your brother, and what's your journey been on this story?
Yeah, so I mean, it wasn't my brother's place of work. I mean, he was only there really to do some networking. Just one of those things, you know, wrong place, wrong time kind of thing. It's been a long journey. I can't believe someone mentioned a couple of days ago, 23 years it's going to be. I started to just, I guess, you know, obviously I was still in shock. But, you know, a couple of months after 9/11, a colleague sent me a link by John Pilger, which was called This War is a Farce. And, you know, I think that was the first time I sort of really thought about, A, what was being done effectively in my brother's name, but, you know, the wider ramifications of what was being carried out because of the events that day. And, you know, I think John Pilger made the sort of observation that, hang on a sec, you know, we've got 15 of the 19 alleged hijackers being Saudi. They did most of their training in the US, some in Germany, etc. Why are we bombing the hell out of Afghanistan? And then obviously went on to Iraq and stuff. And so I really started to look at, I guess, the behavior of the West and the way that we responded. I looked at all the intelligence leading up to 9/11, and there was a lot of good authors, you know, books and stuff that was out there. And it's just been a gradual process. And if we fast forward to, I guess, where I'm at, my brother was identified, small remains of him, and his remains were repatriated back to the UK. And that triggers by law an inquest, which is held in a coroner's court. And this was held in 2013, but it was a very sort of just go through the motions, you know, cut and paste literally of two pages of the 9/11 commission report. But they spent about 3 minutes discussing my brother's life and death, and it was all over with. And around that sort of time, I'd gone kind of public with my concerns about a lot of aspects of 9/11. And I basically sort of thought to myself, hang on a sec, there's a lot of evidence out there that certainly the coroner wouldn't have looked at, which is, you know, evidence of the use of explosives, et cetera, to bring down the towers, which obviously ultimately caused my brother's death. But also that coupled with the fact that, you know, no inquiry was done whatsoever, which by law a coroner is supposed to do. I sort of started to think, okay, is there a way in which I could reopen my brother's inquest? And there is a mechanism through the Coroner's Act 1988, where you petition the Attorney General, you ask for his or her permission to reopen the inquest, and you you basically have to present your case, as it were, on paper as to why there's new evidence, insufficiency of inquiry, etc. And it should be a fairly straightforward process. The threshold's fairly low, and we're well above that. You know, certainly that was the advice from my barrister, or our barrister, because it's my family's application. And anyway, again, fast forward to 2021, we submitted a 2,500 page application, fairly confident that, you know, on paper, the Attorney General should grant her authority. They sat on it for nearly 2 years and came back with a couple of paragraphs refusing permission. And the reasons were ludicrous. They're supposed to apply a test in law. They're supposed to apply law to our request. And they hadn't. And so this was last June. And so we had a process called judicial review here, where you can challenge an authority's decision. It's expensive. You only have 3 months to prepare your case, but we raised funds through crowdfunding, put together our application to basically file for judicial review. And as a warning shot, we sent off a small, like a pre-application protocol letter to the Attorney General saying, these are our grounds. We're going to take you to court because we think your decision was unlawful. And rather amazingly, with a couple of days to the deadline to go, they capitulated and withdrew their unlawful decision and irrational decision from June last year. And then they were able to make a new decision, which, you know, thankfully wasn't nearly 2 years this time. It was only 4 months. But so we're now talking January this year. Again, they've said no. And to be honest, the reasons that they gave are not much better than what they gave in September. I haven't really got, I guess, time to cover what they said. But essentially, they didn't engage with the evidence and have basically dismissed our request, which are not, they're not applying the law. And so another round of crowdfunding, we had a deadline of 3rd of April to file at the High Court to challenge again the Attorney General's decision. So this time we've actually filed directly with the High Court. We have a little bit more documentation that needs to be filed, which will be completed early next week. And then from that point, the Attorney General has 21 days to respond with an to the acknowledgement of service of the papers that we've served on them. They can go one of two ways, which is basically, you know, sorry, yeah, we made a mistake. Here's a consent order to grant permission for reopening my brother's inquest. Or they can say, here are our grounds as to why we think our decision is a lawful one. I have no idea how they're going to respond to that because they really are skating on thin ice.
Matt, we're just going to go into a news break and we'll carry on this topic. We're going to scope out a little bit and talk about the background and what you really think happened. And if there are any other outlets you could use if you exhaust the UK court system. Matt Campbell, whose brother died in 9/11 and he's pursued court cases in the UK to find out the truth. This is Pelle Neroth Taylor Show and we'll be back after the news in about 2 minutes. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show.
Welcome, welcome.
Coming up, important news.
TNT Radio News.
And that's the truth.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. There was high drama in Washington, D.C. after Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene triggered a vote to remove U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson. U.S. President Joe Biden has admitted in a televised interview that Israel has been using American weapons to kill civilians in Gaza. Russia continues to gain ground in Ukraine, seizing two more settlements, and the White House is reportedly considering banning the export of AI models to China.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We've got Matt Campbell with us. He's a Brit and the brother of Jeff Campbell, who's a British citizen who was killed on 9/11 while attending a conference on the 106th floor. A man, the wrong man in the wrong place. And ever since, Matt Campbell's been trying to pursue through the courts and get some kind of clarity or rectification or something. And he's just, in the first part of this show, he's telling the sometimes thankless task of getting through the British justice system. But Matt, can you just tell us a little bit about how, can we go back to 2001, September? I mean, it must have been a terrible, I mean, an event of unbelievable extreme shock to get this about your brother.
Yeah, I mean, we were on holiday, my wife and two young kids. I mean, they were just babies, toddlers. And we'd gone out to Lanzarote in the Canary Islands, and my mum had flown out the day before to join us for the second week of the holiday. And my wife was kind of just, I think, pushing my youngest, she's probably 6 months old, in a buggy to try and get her to sleep, and sort of went up off the beach, you know, where the bars were and restaurants and stuff, and saw a lot of people crowding around, you know, the various TV screens that were there. And yeah, she came running down, sort of said, something's happened. I went up there. I mean, I kind of was concerned, but wasn't too much because obviously it wasn't my brother's place of work. You know, he worked for Reuters up in Midtown. And it was just absolutely frantic. I mean, although, you know, we had mobile phones, I'd left them at the hotel. You know, it wasn't like these days where you wouldn't ever leave your house without your phone. We just left it at the hotel. So I used a public phone box to basically try and call people to try and find out, you know, what was happening, was Jeff there, etc. And I think, you know, probably after a couple of hours, I finally got through to my brother, who I think had spoken to Jeff's fiance out in New York. And I remember just dropping the phone. You know, Mum was in front of me, and she just, you know, could see the effect on me that, you know, it was, you know, terrible news. But we still kept a bit of hope. We finally got back to the UK a couple of days later, clinging to hope that maybe he was unconscious in a hospital or something. But we actually flew out to New York on the Saturday. And I think by the Sunday, you know, we knew he was gone. And yeah, and it's just, you know, tremendous. I mean, not only shock and just trying to process what had gone on, but you know, certainly for the first 9 months, we didn't have any remains of Jeff that had been identified. We didn't know that had been, you know, collected and found. But the first identification didn't come until June 2002, which was a small fragment of his collarbone, and then a couple of years later, three more small bone fragments, and then 4 years later, you know, a bit of his hair and his head and his face and stuff, and then more remains actually came after the inquest in 2013. But we, you know, we are talking no more than probably 3% of his body, and you know, that is quite common. I mean, I think there's something like 22,000 fragments of people of those that died at the World Trade Center.
What we've got 4 minutes, or do you have a theory of what happened? I mean, are you able to give out? Because not the thing is, a lot of our audiences don't know everything about everything we talk about, and it did, after all, happen 22 years ago, I think 23 years ago. So, what is? Do you have a best case theory of what you think happened?
Not really. I mean, because it's such a complex operation. I mean, we know from various records that have come through the court cases or pre-trial, I should say, so that's Guantanamo Bay trial, the Saudi lawsuits, and also a little bit to some extent from the 9/11 Commission, that, you know, Saudi Arabia provided material support to the hijackers. There's no question. You know, you're talking Saudi intelligence, Saudi politicians, royal family, etc. We know that the CIA actively protected two of the alleged hijackers, you know, which to me, whether they were running an illegal op or actually doing something else, who knows? And, you know, and then there's also, I think, to a certain extent, Israeli foreknowledge. What I'm focusing on with my brother's inquest, trying to get that reopened, is narrow in scope. It's only concerned with, you know, basically, how did he come about his death? How did he die? And for that, you know, wherever the evidence may lead, there was a lot of evidence that wasn't looked at by the coroner, which is the evidence of basically the towers being brought down by explosives. And this wouldn't be the first time I attempted it in 1999.
Well, I mean, the killer evidence is the, you know, I mean, the firemen said they saw explosives and they heard pops of explosives. And then you had the other building seven. And then the fact that nothing in history has fallen down at that speed ever. And no skyscraper had been burning for 24 hours in Madrid, I think, and they didn't fall down, and this fell down. And once you get that into your head that it was a controlled explosion, it looks like that when you look at the towers. Are you getting a lot of support from the public on this? You know that.
I mean, I think that there is a lot of support. I mean, I said, you know, the whole thing's been crowdfunded. You know, the various tranches that we've had to raise to the barrister to do his work. I mean, just to go back to about the eyewitnesses and stuff. You know, there's over 150. Eyewitnesses on the day. A lot of them were first responders, so you're calling police officers, you know, firefighters, etc., that were witness to explosions, lights, flashes, etc. There's an awful lot of stuff that is actually part of our application, you know, this testimony that they were witness to 23 years ago, and they're still willing in court under oath to give, you know, share that evidence with the court. So I think the public are generally supportive. I mean, I know there's a lot of theories out there, but, you know, I'm just trying to get to the truth of how my brother died.
Mm. Well, it's pretty significant that you got a lot of witnesses prepared to speak on oath presumably to fly over from New York if they're retired firemen or whatever.
These days, probably it's done by Zoom. So, I mean, a lot of court appearances actually done via Zoom. But, I mean, that's some way down the line. Obviously, we've got to win this court case in the High Court, and then hopefully get it reopened in a coroner's court.
Okay, Matt Campbell, you strike an admirable blow to the truth, and in the memory of your brother Jeff Campbell, who worked for Reuters and died in 9/11 on the 106th floor. Where can we find your stuff or any updates? Because we'd love to know how. We're waiting with bated breath, and really hope you succeed in your long struggle to get it out there and bring it to the legal completion.
Two places. Sorry, Pat.
Yeah, no, we got 20 seconds so left.
On Twitter or X, there's MattCampbell911 is an easy way to follow me. The other way is through the International Center for 9/11 Justice, which is ic911.org. They have longer form news articles, etc., which is also following our case. And they're very supportive of what we're doing and actually working with the barrister, Ted Walters.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Matt Campbell. You can follow your stuff on those websites. And we will go back to you in the days, weeks coming up or months coming up. This is the Pelle Nero Tele Show. We've got to hasten on to our second guest in this Thursday afternoon. Thank you very much. This is the Pelle Nero Tele Show. And we're on to our next guest.
Our beautiful world is changing. Withering, dying, by the hands of those who don't value nature, even though we all depend on it for life itself. But there is hope. Together with caring friends, the Nature Conservancy can restore our lands, heal our waters, and save our wildlife with big solutions only nature can provide. But every day we lose more of the places we love. And we urgently need to save endangered lands, waters, and wild species. The actions we take today will determine the tomorrow we leave to our children and grandchildren. The water they drink, the air they breathe, the beauty they experience. To learn more about how you can help protect and conserve our beautiful world, visit nature.org today.
Most people are unaware that bad bacteria can grow quickly in food that's stored, prepped, or cooked incorrectly, and that can lead to food poisoning. To avoid bad bacteria, always make sure your hands and cooking utensils are clean. Keep raw meat and chicken away from food that won't be cooked. Run your fridge at or below 5 degrees Celsius and use a meat thermometer to ensure your meat's being cooked to at least 75 degrees Celsius. For more tips on keeping bad bacteria at bay, visit foodsafety.asn.au.
From the Cold War to propaganda and the deep state.
Pelle Neuroth Taylor
on today's News Talk, TNT.
Okay, welcome back to the Pelle Neuroth Taylor Show. Well, we're taking a bit of a break from the propaganda, the deep state and the nuclear war stuff, and talking a little bit about the Eurovision Song Contest, which is apparently the world's largest music cavalcade. And that's the reason why I'm in Malmo, which is Sweden's third largest city. And that's where the Eurovision Song Contest is taking place. Apparently, there are major security measures all over the place because Israel is participating and it's a heavily Muslim city. We're going to talk a little bit about Eurovision and the history of Eurovision and this political significance at a time when actually Europe does seem to be splintering apart a little bit. The European Union has never been less popular, and we're suffused with immigration, wars on our frontiers, failing innovation, and other serious stuff. But we've always got Eurovision, I suppose, even though some people are critical of it. Ingrid Carlqvist is one of Sweden's top media profiles. She's a former news editor of one of Sweden's biggest tabloids. She's based in Malmo, and she's a writer and podcast and a very well-known person, a commentator on many interesting issues. Welcome to the show, Ingrid.
Thank you very much, Pelle.
So tell us a little bit about what you've been following up on Eurovision, because the media, Swedish media, have been full of it, sometimes talking about the music, sometimes talking about the security measures, and sometimes talking about there was a Quran burning, I think, wasn't there? I think tell us about the Swedish thing about Quran burnings, because I think that to me is a good sign of Sweden. I don't think you could burn the Quran in the UK, for instance. So, I mean, What is this?
And you can't even do it in Denmark now these days. Right. They just made a new law saying that you cannot burn the Quran, you cannot burn any religious books and offend religious people. But in Sweden, we still have the possibility to do that. And it all started with the Danish politician Rasmus Paludan. He had been doing that in Denmark for many years. And then 2022, before the Swedish elections, it was around Easter time, and the elections was in September, and he started a party, a Swedish party, Rasmus Paludan, and he went on a tour in Sweden, and he burned Korans in some cities, not in all the cities he planned, because there were so many murderous Muslims trying to kill him, so the police wouldn't even let him into the city where he was going to burn it. And it was horrible, and that woke very many Swedes up. He didn't get many votes for his party, but I'm sure that the reason the Sweden Democrats grew so much in that election, that was just because of Paludan, because mm-hmm. he made a lot of Swedes see that, I mean, in many of these cities, Rasmus wasn't even there, but they still made havoc. They were rioting. They were throwing stones at police cars and police officers. It was mayhem. And that really woke Swedes up. Oh, my God, what is this we've got in our country?
Mm. And some of the Qurans, were they burnt by Muslim apostates as well, or Muslim Christians from the Middle East? So
well,
he was,
there was... Yeah. There was this guy called Salwan Mumika, and he was supposedly from Iraq. Some say he was a Christian, but he had been in some army in the Muslim community. So I don't think that he really did it because he didn't like the Quran. I think he was on a mission to make problems for Sweden, because this was in the campaign that many Muslims had, that Sweden is a horrible country, the social authorities, they kidnap Muslim children and put them in Christian homes. It's totally lies, of course. But I think that what he wanted was to make trouble for Sweden. And then we kicked him out, and he went to Norway, and they didn't want him. So now I don't really know where he is, but he's not burning any Qurans anymore. And now there is this Christian woman that has picked up the glove, so to speak, and she has done some Quran burnings. And she was in Malmö last weekend, and it was not riots, but she got attacked. And she said that she would tell us all about it in a few days.
Mm. So Rasmus Paludan burnt some Qurans. There were a huge reaction from the Muslim community, and that led to a rise in the support. Do you think Rasmus rise in support for the anti-immigrant party SD, Social Sweden Democrats, who have been bubbling under the radar for 15 or 20 years, but finally made their breakthrough because they're sort of supporting the government now, which is conservative, and are they're making headway in their policies? Are they towards immigration?
Yeah,
are they having?
They are.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Many things are in the making, but you know, new laws take a lot of time. You have to investigate the whole thing and send it out for, you know, organizations to say their stuff about it. So they have put many things in moving, but we still haven't seen a decline in how many people were coming into Sweden last year. It was 100,000, as it normally is, or has been since the millennial. And 60,000 people got Swedish citizenship. And that is a great disappointment, I think, because I think that the Sweden Democrats could have negotiated a moratorium on new citizenships until we have new laws in place that say that you cannot be a criminal, you cannot live off welfare, and a lot of stuff that we will do, but it's not in place yet. And so many people living here, they're just, you know, oh, well, I want to be a citizen because I don't want to be kicked out.
I'll just pick you up on that statistic, because I made a film called Sweden Dying to Be Multicultural a few years ago, and it was in the wake of this massive refugee influx. The Americans I talk to every day on this show talk about what's happening in America now, but actually it happened in Sweden a few years ago. Military-age men walking down the motorway in Denmark or Germany, aiming for Sweden. They always had iPhones, but strangely enough, they all lost their passports, and they were young, male, sometimes quite good-looking, you know, and they came to the Malmö Central Station and got their food and sort of all these refugees welcome and young women, you know, all over them. And say, and at one point, I think there were 1,000 refugees coming in every day. So that's 365,000 refugees a year. And I said to my Swedish acquaintances and friends, you are destroying your country, because in 5 years, 365,000 a year is one Malmo every year. You know, it's going to be destroy your country. In 10 years, you'll lose majority status. And they said, no, you can't. You couldn't talk about it. It's compact refusal. Mm. It's like talking about death or something. It's really, and people have these mechanisms for not for excluding you. And then I lost interest. I thought I'll prove my point. But then, because then the government said, oh, immigration has gone down. It's not happening anymore. But you just cited that statistic of 100,000, which shows that even when there's a right-wing government in place, it's the same number as before. And yeah, Sweden is still becoming slow processed another country.
That's true. But the asylum seekers are just like 16,000 or something like that. The other ones is, you know, family members and people who come here to work. And they have put things in place, because before you could have a cousin living in Stockholm, for example, and he has this kebab place, and there are lots of people unemployed in Sweden, but he can bring his relative. So that is something that's been going on, but they are stopping it now, because now you have to have quite a big salary to be able to go to Sweden to work. You cannot just earn pocket money, so to speak.
Right, because these kebab shops, they hired 8 onion peelers who all had to be employed from this remote village. They couldn't employ a local onion peeler. Okay, there's an enormous amount of corruption in this whole process. But I mean, that said, the Malmo that I do get pushback from people, because my film was so apocalyptic, and they say, well, Malmo looks like a normal city. Yes, it is more and more immigrants, but you know, I had a taxi driver last night who was a Muslim, and he was kind of nice, and he's saying, oh, we need this Eurovision Song Contest, it brings in the money. And sometimes I sometimes wonder, did we exaggerate the threat? Do you ever have any of those thoughts?
Yeah, I always, you know, think maybe I'm wrong, and that would be good if I was wrong, but I'm not wrong, and you weren't wrong, because as long as they get everything they want, as long as they don't see us burning Qurans or talking about Islam as a threat, then it's okay. But as soon as we do that, we have had so many riots in Sweden, and people, as I said, the Swedes have now woken up. And one thing where we can see this is not only that the Sweden Democrats are supporting the government, but also you can say almost anything now. Just a couple of years ago, there was this, I don't know if you can find an English word for åsiktskorridoren.
Yeah, opinion corridor. It's used in English as well, actually.
Okay,
it's imported. Yeah. It comes from Swedish. I mean, they took it from Swedish debate.
It's gone, Pelle. It's gone. You can say anything. And that is a great change, because most Swedes have been very scared of being called a racist and Islamophobe and all these things. But now the party leader of the Sweden Democrats, he said a couple of months ago that I think that one day we will have to close mosques where they preach hatred against Western societies. And of course, the other politicians were, oh my God, you can't say that. But people loved it. People love that he said that, because finally Swedes have got some hope again that we can save this country.
I'll just sort of change the subject a little bit, because we've got this Eurovision Song Contest now, and Swedes win it with regularity, and they've infiltrated the entire management of the International Eurovision Song Contest thing. But of course, when people say Swedish music, everyone will say ABBA. And interestingly, my studio manager here Australia. He was a reporter, you know, for their tour in 1977. So there's that film about Australian reporters chasing these young women. And I think many people still think that Sweden is the Sweden of ABBA, of Agneta Fältskog, but it's not that Sweden anymore. It's a sort of tragedy in a way. It's not the Sweden of, it's more like this. How would you contrast the Sweden of the 1970s with ABBA and their barefoot dancing in the summer grass, you know, and Sweden of today?
I think we really didn't understand how lucky we were. We were one of the most homogeneous countries in the world. Almost only Swedes lived here, some Norwegian and Danish and some Englishmen and so on. But, you know, it was a very, very quiet and safe society. And some people thought it was boring, but I don't think that they really appreciate all these gang shootings, murders in you know, everywhere, and the rapes, the gang rapes and all that. And there was an interesting story the other day. There was this female journalist working for the Swedish radio, and she has been there. Oh, come on. Why are you so afraid? Just look people in the eye and see that they are people and we can all get along. And now someone shot into her neighbor's door in the middle of the night, and she was all over, you know, television and writing stuff. Oh, this is horrible. This is horrible. We can't have it like this. Well, you were one of those that made it like this because you refused to see. It's not that no good people have come to Sweden, but there are so many. And among all these people that have come, there are so many now related to this gang criminality. They speak about 68,000 people being involved, more or less. And they're also getting into the authorities, you know, the social authority, and they are everywhere. They are infiltrating. They have infiltrated the police, the prison system, and it is really, really horrible. So I do hope that the government, they are not, you know, they have understood a lot of things, but they are still, we can't be, you know, we have international laws that we must. But I hope that very soon they will wake up and see we have to start sending people back to their countries if we want a Sweden.
Well, I mean, this thing about the infiltration, of course, is, I mean, once Sweden was a very highly taxed country, but it was also very honest and non-corrupt and a very strong state, which parceled out many benefits. But it was also a benefit system based on you working all your life and then getting those benefits when you were raising children or whatever. But now, of course, a lot of that enormous sums of money that are sloshing through the tax system are taken out by the criminals in some ways. And as you said, one little concrete thing that really told a story to me was the way that young police women have been sleeping with the gangsters because they've been seduced by their cool lifestyles. And they've been telling those gangsters about the cases against them and about the secrets of the police institution to allow the gangsters to maneuver around the system. And that's very telling somehow, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, like 15 years ago, they started with this. They had these posters in the subways and on the trains and buses. Do you want to become a police officer? We are looking for women and people with not a non-Swedish background. And I said, then they are crazy. You can't, you need to have the best people. You can't say, oh, you're a woman. And so what happened? They needed more police. So they lowered the standards year by year. And now there are a lot of these betraying women police officers that have, you know, gone over to the criminal side and still working in the police. How many people have been killed because of them? So I think that more police, that was a really bad thing. It would have been better if we had stayed with the police force that we had, and then it would have been better because they have really destroyed the police work And I think that this was actually the biggest newspaper in Sweden, the Daily News.
Very liberal.
Yeah.
Exactly. So surprising. I wouldn't have expected that.
It does show you that the climate
has changed because
a
lot of these, thanks Ingrid, a lot of these journalists live in the area called Södermalm in Stockholm, which is a sort of left bank of Sweden. The elites live and they mix with each other. They sleep with each other. They go to each other's parties, give each other awards. And it's an almost all white community. They talk about their leftist credentials, but they don't actually mix with the people they rule over. And of course, the migrants come into the suburbs or to Malmo. And we could talk about that another time because the Malmo region is sort of disadvantaged compared to Stockholm. And you sometimes think, well, they'll dump all the social problems on this region. Ingrid Karlqvist, one of Sweden's top journalists, a former news editor and a podcaster. Karlqvist, unfortunately, I think she blogs mostly in Swedish, but you can follow her stuff using Google Translate. It's lovely to have you on. And we will talk to you soon and interview you soon again, as we talked about on the email. This is the Pelle Nerov-Taylor Show. We're going to go into our next hour and further guests and talk about Eurovision and other interesting things. This is the Pelle Nerov-Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. Back after the break.